so I think I spoke too soon. I'm going to play a bit more, since we have some extra time, of the Glover Crone recall resistance, that kind of a forum that was held with these two candidates answering questions from the audience in the Loudoun-Nelson area on the January 29th. And I'm going to take a selection, a part of that, which you can find the entire thing, of course, at the archives, as I mentioned before, at different points on these broadcasts. If you go to Latest and Lost Shows, which is a link under Bathrobes Pierre's Broadside section of the Huff website at huffsantacruz.org. Here's a bit more of this January 29th forum. Again, I think to be followed by a flashback, assuming I can find one that's of suitable quality.
Okay, we can take the next three questions.
Yeah, I've got a handout that goes along with my question comment. I don't really need a microphone. I'm a poor builder. I mean, I'm an excellent builder who is poor, and put it that way. And what I'm handing out is a story pole ordinance that Santa Clara has. And I talked with Catherine Beyer, a former mayor, who told me that there used to be a story pole ordinance in this city. And if you look at the back side of the ordinance, you'll see that a story pole is where you create the shape of the building out of 2x4s or pipe, and then you hang orange netting on it so that people can see the mass of what's being proposed and how much sunlight is being blocked for the neighbors. And it gives the public an opportunity to grasp what is about to occur. Most, even the people that I work for, don't understand their own plans until the 2x4 is up and go, oh my God, this kitchen's way too small. Okay? So what I would ask of you guys, are you willing to pursue story pole ordinance as part of planning for development as an inclusive measure for the neighbors so that they can understand what's about to happen? I think those of you on the west side, if you've seen a story pole like this that was 70 feet tall at 190 West Cliff, you would have driven off the road looking out your window going, oh my God, that's so big. Okay, so this is how the community gets involved in building and doesn't go, not in my backyard, but if you're going to be there, be respectful of me, who's already here. So that would be my question. Are you willing to pursue story polls?
I will dissect that question after the next two. Just writing it down. Hi. First, I'd like to thank you for your service. I know you probably barely get a living wage living here doing what you do. But I do have to say I'm in the middle ground as of now, as far as the recall goes. A big reason is my question to you, Glover, because I didn't see Cron behind Ross Camp as much as you. As a business owner, a homeowner, people who've owned businesses in that area, how you could stand in front of us as the people who are taxpayers and say that it was a safe place for people to live after all that went down, thousands of needles recovered, people dying, rapes, overdoses. How can you, as a council member, stand in front of us, the people who voted you in and may vote you out, say that you stand behind a camp like that? It was appalling what was going down there. So that's a big question. I want to know how you can stand behind drug addicts that need help and provide needle reduction being handed out by the hundreds to thousands and be okay by that. And as someone who's going to vote in March, and many of us are, I would like to know the answer. Thank you. Is there a third question out there?
Yes. Hi, my name's Elise Casby, and I have been attending city council meetings for the last 6 years, so long before the progressives were elected. Chris and Sandy were the first two, and then Drew and Justin were the second two so-called progressives to be elected. So long before that, I was going to about 80% of the city council meetings. Don Lane called me a fixture. So I became extremely concerned about the situation where we activists would come in, people who are interested in environmental measures, affordable housing. We wanted shelters for the homeless, et cetera, et cetera. And then we would leave, and the developers would come in. It was like there were two completely separate city council meetings for a long time. So when it came to the recall, I noticed that there was what I would call an upgrade of escalation. So we couldn't get things on the agenda. I started to actually initiate a small group about that, trying to find out why can't we progressives get anything on the agenda. And then Mayor Watkins came out with her accusations of bullying. So what I saw, and this is just a little prelude, I'm almost finished to my question, I saw this tremendous escalation of what I considered an aggressive attack on progressives, specifically you two. And I was really concerned about that because I was already looking into why can't we get things on the agenda? What's going on here? Then I saw this attack, but nothing compared to what I saw this summer. I personally heard signature gatherers saying horrendous things that I absolutely know were not true. Accusing you two of being sexual predators to campus students who knew nothing about what was going on. I didn't have a good phone to photograph or film this stuff. Unfortunately, I have a very, moderate phone. I would not have been able to withstand the kind of lies that have been coming out, the accusations which have continually been proven to be false, and the Sentinel and the Good Times also purveying these lies. So my question to you two, and I know this is a little different. I'm an insider activist. I've been a longtime activist. I've been scrutinizing city council for 6 years. How are you able, I really want to know this, and I want the audience to know this. How are you two individually, I want each of you to answer this, able to be so peaceful, to be so neutral? I mean, I was just sitting there. There's things I want you to say. I'm like fighting. I want you to say this. I want you to say that. And you're both so moderate in your tone. And I want you to tell us how, with what I'm going to call defamation of character and all that, the slander that's going on, right from the pages of the Sentinel, the lies about the Rose Report that the Sentinel promoted. How are you able to stay so, what I consider, moderate, grounded? I want you to talk about this to community.
So I'm going to summarize the last three questions. First question was from an excellent builder, described himself as poor. He wants to know, after considering some of the ordinances passed in Santa Clara around story poles, excuse me if I said that wrong, would the council members consider passing something like this so that communities can better understand a development's impact environmentally, socially? Another question on what did you two mean by calling the Ross Camp safe when you were defending it earlier in the year? And how are you able to be peaceful and neutral in the face of escalating accusations against your character?
We're on the list. Story polls, I'm totally on board, and I've already approached the planning director about it. Get a lot of pushback from him, and he does not want them. Too expensive was his first thing. It's going to be a struggle, but this is part about getting your ducks in a row. So when we do that story poll, and it might take a month or two to get it together where we present it to the council and we have some people come in and say these things work, other people like Lee coming in, hey, we do it in Santa Clara, and show some pictures and say, I think it's possible. So I'm on the story pole. Ross Camp, I think it was the a bad situation of a lot of worse situations. So what happened was, for the first time in Santa Cruz history that I know of, there was a sanctioned camp for people who don't have houses at 1220 River Street. We had 62 or 64 tents there. Probably about 80 some people were being housed there. The city manager, on his own, I don't think he consulted the council, I don't remember being consulted, closed the camp because he said there's a water project that had to take place, something that had to go under the San Lorenzo River. It was a very technical kind of project. It was going to be long-term, or it's going to take a lot of time. So he just closed the camp without identifying another place. So a group of people who left that camp went to behind Ross Camp. And then that camp grew because a lot of people said, oh, you please don't sleep here, but you can go sleep over at Ross Camp. So it kind of, and this is happening all over the West Coast, and I don't want to minimize it by saying that, because a lot of people in government right now are minimizing their responsibilities because they're, oh, it's happening everywhere. So we've got to take care of people here in Santa Cruz, our people. And 72% of the people in the surveys that have been done are from Santa Cruz. They've been here, grew up here. Of course, we all know the opioid crisis is just tearing apart so many communities in this country. That was not a good place. I don't think either of us felt like that was a safe place, but for many people who are alone and out in the streets, when we interviewed them, talking to them, they said it was a safe place. So it wasn't just, you know, us saying it's a safe place. I don't think either of us think that was a very good place, the way it was set up. There was no structures. And I think that it put a lot of fear in the community. And then when it was disbanded, where did all the folks go that were living there? They went back to, you know, I jog alongside Holy Cross, that there's a Caltrans property there. That was a big encampment at one time. Then people came back there. They were in doorways downtown along Pacific Avenue. Now the post office has many campers. So if we don't do something, we've really been systematically undermined. I don't know if people remember, oh, let's put a camp at the Depot Park. No, nobody on the council, I thought, took that, but the neighbors did, and when the city manager's office put that out there, people freaked out, and because we didn't consult the neighbors. We didn't do what we say we want to do. We want to interview neighbors, talk to them, make sure they're on board before we do this kind of stuff. So I'm very frustrated with the situation of how we address homelessness in Santa Cruz. For example, the city manager, again, just closed the rock. He reopened 1220 River Street when he said there was going to be a big construction project there. And I'm not blaming him. I'm trying to tell you the story that we're confronted with. He said, oh, we're going to close 1220, but we've got the armory. And then I'm getting calls from people in Prospect Heights who say, what is this? You know, and so we did have a couple, they had a couple meetings out there. We relocated people to the armory, that you can have as many as 80 people there. But the armory is going to close March 15th, and we don't have a backup plan yet. So I got an email from him the other day. His name is Martin Bernal. He's the city manager. He's like a CEO, and he hires and fires all department heads. The city council, the seven of us, hire and fire the city manager and the city attorney. That's the two people that we hire and fire. He hires and fires everybody else. He said, oh, somebody's going to donate a piece of property, but he wouldn't tell me who yet. maybe we can locate people and have a camp there. So that's his idea, I think. As far as the last question sounded like self-care that Elise was asking about, yes, I came on board knowing this was going to be tough. I had been on the council from 98 to 2002. I was mayor in 2002. I kind of knew that how city government works. We have a very difficult and dysfunctional is an overused word, but the way this council manager's form of government works, I mean, you can go and get a degree in it. It is puts the city council, and it came out for a really good reason, because a boss Tweed in the 1870s was hiring all of his family members to be on staff and staff the city jobs in New York City. And out of that grew a movement of technocrats and to make the situation more technical. And by the 1940s, it was in major use, city manager form of government. And in fact, it is the main form of government in most towns in California. I can't remember the exact number. But I think my own personal feeling is that Santa Cruz has outgrown a city manager's form of government. I think we should directly elect the mayor. As far as district elections go, I think we should have a community-wide debate on that. I'm not, I don't have a strong opinion either way. It may be forced on us for the wrong reasons, but that's another story. My self-care is I do a yoga 3 times a week, I meditate, and I hang out with students on campus because they are my teachers. They're amazing. They get all the stuff that we've already thought about, they're thinking about, but they're thinking about it in a different way. They've got a little bit of a different take on it. It fascinates me, and I learn from them every day. Thank you. Okay, so first, story polls. I would be more than happy to see that brought to the City Council and discussed. Interesting to hear the pushback already from the Planning Department, but I think that I would love to work with community members like yourself and other quality core builders and builders alike that are interested in the concept, work out a plan, and then see what we can do in the City Council. I don't know if I just because of Brown Act stuff, I don't want to say whether I support or don't support them, but I would love to see them come to the City Council in general. Okay, the Roskam. I love that you asked that question because it's something that's a centralized topic, especially around the recall. They used that as one of their primary leading arguments when they were collecting signatures. But the problem, which I would not have had a problem with, if they were telling the truth, even on the petition. So some of the things that you said actually represents some of the misinformation that was included on that petition, which I can totally understand how it could be kind of misleading and give you the wrong perception of what my actual argument was. So with regards to the Roskam, I'm on record with saying that there were problems at the Roskam. There were health and safety issues, there were fire issues, there were crime issues, and there were drug use issues. So the statement on the recall petition that says that I quote said that there were no health and safety violations in a declaration to the court when I submitted my official declaration is incorrect. And I would encourage you, if you don't believe me for whatever reason, to go and look at my declaration because it specifically says that there were no imminent or unmanageable risks to health and safety. And I said that because when I came into office, outside of renter's protections, which was one of the first things that we addressed in the second meeting of January, and that was actually, just for the record, was the first time that this group that is now Santa Cruz United used the recall as a political weapon. They wrote to the City Council and said that if you pass renter's protections or anything that even resembles just cause eviction, that we're going to use a recall and a referendum to remove you from office. So that really struck me because being a new person in office, to have a group of people threaten me, essentially, if I vote for or support a policy they disagree with was very troubling just to begin with. But immediately after that, and even during that process, I was working with advocates and people that were currently experiencing homelessness to try and craft a multi-point plan to address issues like the Roskam, because the Roskam started forming in November-ish of 2018. So by the time I got into office and was able to actually start making moves as far as policy goes, that was the end of January to the beginning of February. So it had already compounded on itself and become a far too dense location with people living in the mud. There's the piece that I wrote, which is what the mayor cited as bullying, which was, it's called A Fierce Urgency of Now, and it's on my Facebook page, and that was in reference to Dr. King and his quote that encompasses that phrase. And in that piece, I have pictures and essentially a description of what I saw when I went to the camp. People with wounds on their legs that were just completely untended to. People living in the mud, no access to food. I went down there to distribute food, which is how I engaged with people that first time to get an idea of what was going on. And then I came forward with this packet, which is now called the Homelessness Motion, if you read about it in papers and everything. But it was a multi-point plan that addressed not only the issues of the Roskam by advocating for what's called transitional encampments. And for those that don't know or are unfamiliar with the term, transitional encampments are data-driven spaces, essentially, or data-driven tools to provide a safe emergency place for people to sleep so they're not sleeping out in the woods or under bridges or on the side of roads being criminalized by police, but also incorporates a very intentional structure that makes it so that there's no drug, alcohol, sexual activity, minors, or any of these other kinds of things that could be allowed in the camp at all. That provides multiple benefits.
One is it creates a safer space for people to be able to sleep and exist. It also makes it so that those compounding issues that you spoke about with neighborhood crime and impacted businesses almost are non-existent, because in the implementation of the transitional encampments comes intentional community engagement and regular meetings with the surrounding neighbors, so that not only does it create a sense of community between the two groups, but it allows for the neighbors to have an open line of communication with the nonprofit managing the space and facilitate corrections if there are undue impacts to the surrounding community. The other benefit to them in the model that I was advocating for is a required sweat equity of the people that participated. So any resident of the camp was required to contribute 10 hours of their time every week or month, depending on the structure of the camp, in volunteer roles. Because there's that saying out there that if someone gives you something for free, then you don't care about it. But if you work for something, then you have ownership over it and you want to protect it. And that's the same concept of that sweat equity, is that if someone is participating, not in a paternalistic role where people are being paid to supervise them, but where they're an active part of the community, picking up trash, volunteering at the front gate, cleaning the bathrooms, doing these other kinds of things, then not only does it give them that sense of ownership, but when they see other people breaking the rules, they will step in to stop them because they don't want for that to jeopardize what they're helping to build. Unfortunately, as Councilmember Crone mentioned, the implementation of that plan and the implementation of the identification of locations was flawed. I was a new council member when I came in, and in making the suggestion of the city to identify potential locations for the implementation of these transitional encampments, they did not participate in the necessary public outreach. And even when we gave the direction to, say, move on Depot Park, there was no intentional staff-driven outreach process to that neighborhood to make sure that there was engagement. It was my fault for assuming that that would take place, because there have been people in the city government far longer than I have been, and I'm not a politician, so I was assuming that the staff, knowing the reaction from the community over decades of trying to address the issue of homelessness, would proactively engage and have those conversations. So I accept full responsibility for not spelling out in very specific direction to implement that strategy when I made the proposal. But to get back to the Ross Camp, because that kind of gives you an idea of what I was advocating for and trying to achieve with the Ross Camp, is that I went and met every week with the people that live there. Every week, standing meeting, 3 o'clock on a Monday, I would go down to the camp, and anyone that wanted to come and talk to me could come and engage around the situations they were dealing with and the problems that they were having, as well as the solutions they wanted to see implemented. There was a group that called themselves the Ross Camp Council. They were kind of self-identified as the leaders of the group, but they were people that had influence over the rest of the people in the camp and were able to implement things. The number one thing I heard from the women in the camp was that they felt safer there. Now, whether or not it was a safe place, they felt safer there because of the reduction that they felt that they were exposed to sexual and physical violence while they were there. As well as the sense of community. There were many times when people said that there were domestic situations where a husband was getting rough with, or a male partner was getting rough with a female partner, and other male residents of the camp would step in and stop that situation from happening, which is not what would happen if they were alone in the woods, or if a woman was sleeping under a bridge and had no one there to observe what was going on. I think there's a there's this claim, it's a popular narrative online, that I, for some reason, even though I was born and raised here, ran for office, run nonprofits, and work with people that are trying to make the community better, somehow want to support open-air drug dens, and that I'm friends with all the heroin dealers, and somehow I'm getting a cut of all of the money that they're making on selling heroin to people, or all of these other really crazy claims. But it's easy to project on me, one, because I used to be a photographer in an atmosphere where there was drug use, 100%. I was also arrested once for a drug crime. Now, the record of that is problematic, because I was poor, I was not selling drugs, I was in a place where there was drugs being used, it was a large event, a huge concert, and because I had a public defender, they told me, don't challenge it and take a plea deal. Even though there was no evidence to support their claims, they told me to take a plea deal. And because I was poor, and they said that if it went to a jury, they were going to try to make a point and I would lose, then I took the plea deal and then got that on my record. Now the opposite, or the proponents of the recall now wave that around and say, look, he was arrested once for drug use, he must be a drug dealer, and that's the reason why he's supporting the camp, because he wants to make money off of drugs. And this kind of feeds into the next question, but that's incredibly painful for me for a variety of reasons, especially because I have never sold drugs in my life. And it's really hard to, especially people that have never met me before or don't know me, that they come up with these assumptions about my character because of things that people online who have never met me said. And along with that claim about the petition gatherers, there are recorded statements of people making completely fallacious claims about myself, my character, my actions, and that's been really consistent through this entire process. So just to end this question, which I hope I provided some context for, is that I did not support the Ross camp. I supported what the Ross camp could be with intentional retrofitting and reformation of the structure, and that's what my votes were time and time again, was not to close the camp, but to move people temporarily, clean up the space, and then allow them to come back again with structure. It was only, and only would I be willing to close the camp if there was adequate shelter. And that brings us to the federal court case, because that's another claim on the recall petition, is that I testified against the city in court, which is true. I totally did. I was asked by the people and the residents of the Ross camp, who understood my arguments and what I was trying to do, to come and testify in federal court in San Jose. And when I was there, my statements were exactly the same. Look, there are problems, but we can fix them without displacing these people because we don't have shelter. Now, the city representatives came to court those 2 days we were there, and they swore up and down under federal oath that we had enough shelter space to be able to close the camp, which the judge eventually bought that story, and we closed the camp. We did not have enough shelter. In fact, we put people in hotel rooms guaranteeing them 5 days, but we gave them 2-day vouchers on a Friday. So their vouchers ended on a Sunday, and they couldn't get in touch with the city to get any more vouchers. So I was receiving phone calls on my personal cell phone from people that were being kicked out of hotel rooms with nowhere else to go because we didn't have ample shelter because we closed the Ross camp and there was nowhere else for them to be. So it's a big issue. There's a lot of moving pieces that go into it. But if you understand the timeline and the approach that I've tried to take since the very beginning when getting into office, watch the tapes of city council meetings, listen to my arguments, read the pieces I put out online. I'm not trying to turn Santa Cruz into one giant homeless camp. I'm trying to make it so that people that are experiencing homelessness have safe places to go. People that are housed have the relief of not having to have people sleep in their neighborhoods or in their front lawns because there's a place for them to go. And for business owners, they won't be in your doorways when you go to open up in the morning because they have somewhere to be. They don't want to be in your doorway. They don't want to poop and pee in your doorway. I mean, I'm not sure if that's a problem that you're having, but I hear that consistently from business owners of them having to come early in the morning and shoo people away. And that's solely because of the failure of policy that we've had in the city for a generation, if not longer, that has resulted in all these people being and having nowhere to go, as well as lack of renter protections. Now, I'll do this last one really quick, because I know I took a lot of time. I hope I provided context with people to understand where I'm coming from, though. Self-care. So self-care is a very important question. It is something that I struggle with every day. I work at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and I find a lot of solace in that for a variety of reasons, predominantly because what's happening to myself and Councilmember Crone is what happens to anyone that challenges the system. If you look historically at nonviolent change makers or people that are pushing for civil justice in any of its forms, even environmental justice, the system that controls the decisions or the people that influence that system will do what they have to do to maintain power. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now with this recall. It has nothing to do, it has nothing to do with the claims that are made about the workforce or the respectful workplace conduct policy. There were issues there, absolutely, but that's not the reason why they're trying to remove us. They're trying to remove us because we represent a perspective that has been pushed down to the bottom of the dialogue forever, And we are fighting so that we can hold developers accountable. Now, knowing all of that, is it difficult? Yes. It is a constant wearing on my spirit. Every time and it's not people in public, because people in public, they come up to me and they're like, we love you, you're doing great, how can you deal with this? I'm so sorry, we're behind you all the way. But it's the people online and the people that will not face me face to face. And I think that's one of the most telling things, is that if you look online at the Santa Cruz United website, there are 23 reasons why they think you should recall me. I went through that list, which I'll be releasing soon, and I refuted each one of them. Out of all of them, there are maybe 3 true statements, but the way they're phrased is misleading. The rest of them are either categorically false or misleading in the way that they're framed. So I have twice now challenged Santa Cruz United to a public debate. Twice. Once during the signature gathering period, which they said they were too busy gathering signatures, and most recently during this this campaigning process, which they've said they're too busy campaigning. So it's a pattern with them, is that they will put out massive amounts of money to spread misinformation, send glossy mailers to all of your houses, but they won't face me in person to address these claims they've made against me so I can hold them accountable for the stuff that they're saying to mislead voters. And so I find strength in that as well. Because if they truly were able to argue their points, then I would be in trouble. But they can't. And so I look to the past for security. I get security from thinking about what the future holds. But also, it is very, very hard. Like today, and I'll stop after this. Today on my Facebook page, there was a, I'm gonna use a unsavory word, so I want to warn you ahead of time. There was a group or a page that was created called Recall Dem Scumfuck Bastards in Santa Cruz ASAP. So that gives you some of the vitriol that I have coming at me from online. There are people that are making crazy games. Then they put a GIF, one of those moving images, of Trump waving bye-bye. So my response was, before it magically disappeared, was thank you for providing a visual representation of your ideology and the mascot behind the influence of this recall. And if you'd like, I would love to talk to you in person and face-to-face. Then that disappeared, and another one popped up with a new page called Drew Drug Lover, asking where they can find drugs. So this is a great example of some of the stuff that I don't want to speak for Councilmember Crone, are dealing with, but it's the support of the community and the knowledge that what I'm doing is the right thing to do. And I will continue to do what I feel is the right thing to do, regardless of the threats that are made against me and regardless of the attacks on my character, because when the dust settles, we'll know that we're on the right side of history. Thank you.
And to hear the rest of that, just go online to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org. Check out latest and last shows, and you'll find it under the January 29th heading, Recall Resistance, Glover and Crone, Fight Back.